You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
These are times of crisis in the existing global systems of capitalism and empire. In earlier eras of crisis and revolutionary change, such upheavals were accompanied by a proliferation of polemic, not rhetoric, but passionate, blunt, clarifying, and accessible analysis of the existing conflicts. Verso Publishers in Britain are reviving this polemical tradition with a series of short books under the general heading Counterblasts. And one of the first to be published in this series is written by Vancouver author and activist Derek O'Keefe. It is titled Michael Ignatieff, The Lesser Evil. Derek has joined me to discuss his book. Welcome, Derek, and thank you for coming down to the studio.
Thank you for having me again.
Before we turn to the book itself on Ignatieff, could you tell us a little more about the inspiration for this series called Counterblasts?
Well, I guess the inspiration from the publisher's point of view, Verso, is just the history of revolutionary and radical polemics. And they trace it back to the Levellers and the first British Revolution, I guess. But they were also very very prominent, played a prominent role during the French Revolution, the Cuban Revolution. And those two in particular were pamphlets and short books that I remember reading when I was first becoming politicized, The Rights of Man, Common Sense by Thomas Paine, in defense of the American and French Revolutions, sharp polemics against the Edmund Burkes and other reactionaries of the time, and also the pamphlets of Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, other leaders of the Cuban Revolution. So certainly, not to put this on that level, but it's an interesting timing for this new series from Verso, coinciding with a year that has really seen an upsurge and a global rebellion against capitalism and empire, even if it's at a very early stage. I think for the first time in my lifetime, we can say that we have the beginnings of a global movement that's very conscious of developments in on the other side of the world. And just to give one example, the Egyptian Revolution that inspired us all, the uprising there that took place in January. They continue in very difficult circumstances to try to go forward there in Egypt, but they're also reaching out and showing solidarity with the Occupy movement that's now taking place across North America. And the other day they had a solidarity march from Tahrir Square to the U.S. Embassy in Cairo in solidarity with Occupy Oakland, which had just been brutally attacked by the police. So I think we're in an exciting time of global consciousness that's starting to come together, and I think part of building on that is to weigh in with some sharp polemics against those who would defend the system. And I think that's the idea of this Ignatieff book and of the Counterblast series more generally.
And who are other targets of the Counterblast series that are planned?
Right, I should have mentioned that. Of course, Thomas Friedman is one of the other targets. That book is also coming out, I believe, this month, and I'm very excited to read it. Thomas Friedman has enjoyed this privileged column space in the New York Times for many years and has been an apologist and an advocate of whatever the U.S. And the capitalist system needs. And it's interesting to see him trying to recalibrate and trying to identify in his writing with the Occupy movement and the events of the Arab Spring. So I'm looking very much forward to the takedown of Thomas Friedman. It's called The Imperial Messenger. That's also in this series. And then coming out in a couple of months is a polemic against Bernard-Henri Levy, better known as BHL, a former leftist. He makes a big deal of this, who is now a sort of self-appointed philosopher king and imperial whisperer in the ear of Sarkozy. And BHL recently has been gloating about having encouraged Sarkozy and David Cameron and others to attack Libya. And he's taken credit for having urged on this so-called humanitarian intervention. And that with BHL, I think there's a connection with Ignatieff. Although Ignatieff was very discredited by his loud support for the Iraq War, those broader ideas about empire being a lesser evil and about liberal humanitarian interventionism, they come back into fashion very quickly and very easily because they coincide with the needs of the people who run the world. And so BHL is now enjoying another moment in the sun as he takes credit for the so-called successful intervention in Libya. But of course, we'll see how that plays out over time. But it's a good time to be weighing in against BHL and his role in the French philosophical academic world.
Because Michael Ignatieff came to the awareness of the wider Canadian public by becoming the leader of the Liberal Party and running the elections, and because he has now abandoned that position and the defeat he faced politically, many would treat him as yesterday's man, an irrelevant figure. You obviously don't agree. Why?
Well, I sort of wish that the Canadian establishment would have treated him as an irrelevant figure, but they kept him close to their bosom. Right after he was forced to resign from politics, he announced he had a position at Massey College, which was a college actually founded by his great uncle, Vincent Massey, and he was given this very prominent academic position, and he's teaching now at the University of Toronto there out of Massey College. He's also continuing to get very sought-after column space in the Globe and Mail, Canada's newspaper of record of the Liberal establishment. He actually wrote a feature essay on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And he also in the Globe and Mail, and he also was given column space in the New York Times magazine again to mark the anniversary of 9/11. And in neither of these feature pieces in the most prestigious publications in North America did he reflect upon his own errors and his own role in the past decade in the war on terror, the wars in Iraq, and the encroachments on civil liberties that all of that entailed. His own errors are sort of glossed over, and he gets again this prominent position as a shaper of public opinion. So I think it is important to really go after his actual record and the whole course of his career, not just his brief time in Canadian politics.
Well, let's look a little bit at a part of his career that's probably less known for a lot of Canadians, because after graduating from the University of Toronto, he went to Oxford in England to continue studies, and later he developed a public career in England. How would you characterize his political outlook and his evolution when he was situated in the British political context?
Sure, and maybe I can just start by adding something to the previous question. I think another reason it's good to go after someone like Ignatieff's record is that we do tend, I think, too much to be intimidated by the establishment institutions. And Ignatieff, as you say, when he went to England, he was at Oxford. You know, he was a television personality for the BBC, wrote in many of the most prestigious publications in the world. So I think there can be a tendency to be intimidated by his CV. And, you know, while he may have made mistakes in politics, look, he was at Harvard, he was at Oxford, he must be a brilliant guy. But if you actually unpack his record, it's really a case of his CV just covering very flimsy ideas, but ideas that serve the interests of power over time. So if we start in Britain, when he arrived there as the late 70s, early 80s, and he was involved in the academic world, and at the time the consensus was sort of a left liberal outlook, at least in the social sciences. And Marxist thought had a big impact and was still very influential. So he sort of naturally gravitated to a leftish crowd in the academic world, and actually he was involved in the History Workshop Journal, still a very reputable and good scholarly publication for sort of a Marxist analysis of the world. And he wrote there, he published a very good book based on his PhD thesis, looking at the prison system during the Victorian era. So he did some good scholarship and some good work and was broadly in this left liberal framework. But then the class struggle happened and the political winds shifted, and Ignatieff sort of showed his true colors. So during the 1984 coal miners' strike, at the peak of what was really a years-long battle between the Thatcher government and the union movement in the UK, Ignatieff used his position at the New Statesman, where he had a column, to sort of weigh in neither for Thatcher nor for the union movement. But what he was really doing was breaking with the left and with the labor movement at a time of life or death struggle. And so this first act of you could say, apostasy, although I don't think he ever truly identified with the left, but this was a way of sort of publicly throwing the left in Britain under the bus and saying, well, you know, it's just not realistic for the coal mines to stay open, the unions are too extreme, the left is too dogmatic. This lost him some of his friends in the academic world that he had originally hung out with in Britain, but it also made him a very sought-after commodity by the establishment in Britain, and this really was one of the things, I think, that propelled him to television opportunities and other very mainstream publications in Britain, and really made him a star of the liberal world in the UK. And yeah, a lot of Canadians don't know that because there was a lot of focus on the fact that he was in the United States, you know, post 9/11 and during the Iraq War. But he actually spent 25 years. The bulk of his adult life, his working career, was spent in England, in the UK.
Well, you mentioned he went to the United States, and that was in 2000, if memory serves me. Yes. And he got a position at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy, that's at Harvard. And this was the brief moment after the collapse of the Soviet Union when U.S. policymakers and leaders believed they would rule the world unchallenged. How does Ignatieff fit himself into this delusion, but even more to the monstrous plans for carrying out American empire worldwide?
Well, first of all, it was Ignatieff was sort of there at the key moments for 3 decades of neoliberalism and empire building. And before he went to the Carr Center for Human Rights in 2000, he played an important role during the 1990s in writing about and justifying NATO's intervention in the former Yugoslavia. So he was well positioned. He was sort of already seeing where the trends were going. Of course, the wars on Yugoslavia were fought without were waged without UN endorsement. They were waged by NATO, part of a trend that would accelerate greatly after 9/11. So he was already well positioned and already moving in this direction. But it's true that his writing in the lead up to the Iraq War and in those early years of the Bush administration, his writing does become sort of less guarded and more just sort of glowing about what America was in the world. You know, that it was this new kind of empire. He rechristened it or rebranded the American empire as Empire Light, and claimed that the American hegemon was unlike any previous empire. So it was better than or more enlightened and more noble, and had this unique role in world history. And he did this working from the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard. So he really gave an important stamp of approval to grotesque violations of human rights that were happening in this period. In one of his lectures that was caught on tape, he went so far as saying that there wouldn't be a notion of international human rights without the United States. And the fact that he could say this at a time when the United States was systematically undermining international conventions against torture, you know, notions of international law that prevented preemptive wars and aggressive wars, the fact that he could make this claim about American exceptionalism just shows really how far down that path he went and how much he was drinking the Kool-Aid, I guess, is not a good expression, or serving the Kool-Aid to the White House. So he became very, very important in those, especially in those months before the Iraq War, when liberal opinion in the United States would have naturally been skeptical of a Republican administration driving for war. He presented a, you know, nominally liberal and human rights case for war and empire. So we should never forgive him for the role he played in those months. He had the cover story of New York Times magazine just 2 months before the war in Iraq was launched. So the war would have still happened without Michael Ignatieff, but he played a key role in apologizing for it and justifying it.
Ignatieff has also got an important family history. He's a descendant of Russian aristocrats who were particularly influential in the last days of the Tsarist regime prior to the Russian Revolution. How would you say Michael Ignatieff relates to his heritage, both self-consciously but also perhaps unconsciously?
Well, the uncut, he did write a book about Freud and was very interested in Freud's ideas early in his career. So I wouldn't dare to sort of comment too much on his unconscious motives. I might be in on my head myself, not having studied Freud. But I think consciously he views himself as having imperial and establishment continuity on both sides of his family. And, you know, we should never blame someone for the family that they come from, but I think he chose to consciously embrace these imperial traditions. And he has as much as said so. And he wrote a book called The Russian Album in 1987, where he sort of describes his own preference for his Russian family roots. He sort of found that more exotic and more appealing. This was on his father's side. So he investigated in the book The Russian Album. And he goes back. His grandfather was the last minister of education for the Tsar, and in fact, rather narrowly escaped with his life. You know, he could have been executed by the Bolsheviks, but there were some of the local Bolshevik committee, you know, had some sympathy for him and was able to get out with his family. But also his great-grandfather was Nicholas Ignatieff, Count Nicholas, who at the time of the assassination of the Tsar in 1881, Alexander II was assassinated. Ignatieff became the Minister of the Interior. And so this is Nicholas Ignatieff, the great-grandfather. At the time, he was the most powerful man in the Russian Empire. And his term as the Minister of the Interior was very short, but it's also very infamous because he imposed the so-called extraordinary and temporary measures that laid out a whole series of violations against any kind of civil liberties. The Tsarist government could shut down any newspaper at any time. They could have summary court martials, you know, essentially getting rid of the trials for potential dissidents. So there were many people executed and targeted and imprisoned during that period, and most especially the Jewish community. These were the years and the months of the most serious pogroms of the 19th century in Russia. And the name, just the name Ignatieff, at that time throughout the Russian Empire, was said to stoke fear amongst Jews at the time. And hundreds of thousands of them left during this period. So Ignatieff has that history with his great-grandfather, and you know, it's my contention that he sort of soft-pedaled it when he writes about it in the Russian Album. He talks about how his great-grandfather had sort of pandered to the anti-Jewish prejudices of the days, but the historical record shows that he was very much a part of the systematic persecution and really what amounted to ethnic cleansing of the Jews in Russia at the time. That this is the era where the notion of the Pale entered our lexicon, that the Pale was a geographic area beyond which Jews were not permitted to go, and they said this was for their own protection, but it was really a form of apartheid or ethnic cleansing. So all of that we could come back to because of some of the things that he's written about Palestine solidarity activists today, I think shows a real hypocrisy. But, you know, that's his father's side of the family. His mother's side is also a very important part of the Canadian establishment over the years. And his great-grandfather on his mother's side, George Monroe Grant, actually did a cross-Canada journey where he surveyed the land for the CPR railway and wrote a book about it called Ocean to Ocean, which was instrumental in putting forward the idea that Canada, for one, needed to expand all the way to the West Coast, and it needed to do this as part of, you know, part of the benevolence of the British Empire and needing to expand and stay within the British Empire system.
There's much more that could be explored. We'll
yes.
Leave that, encourage listeners to read the book. It's called Michael Ignatieff, The Lesser Evil. It's going to be launched on Tuesday night at People's Co-op Bookstore on Commercial Drive.
Yes.
So for people who'd like to get a copy and meet Derek and speak about his book, that's the place to be. I've been speaking with writer and activist Derek O'Keefe. He's co-chair of the Cross Canada Canadian Peace Alliance, and he co-wrote with Afghani activist Malalai Joya her memoir titled A Woman Among Warlords, The Extraordinary Story of an Afghan Who Dared to Raise Her Voice.